many people in America fear their government, and the government is being run by too many powerful agencies like the IRS and others. I think it's time that people take the country back through their representative government.
You are listening to an American Free Press podcast, the complete reading of American Free Press weekly newspaper, number 16, April 18th, 2011. Soros convenes Bretton Woods II, Globalists Set to Rearrange Entire Financial Order, by Pete Papaheraklis. Internationalist billionaire George Soros is holding his international conference April 8 to April 11th at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, the noted birthplace of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, where he plans to rearrange the entire financial order, as he noted in a November 2009 article in the Japan Times Online that signaled the coming conference. This Bretton Woods II came along just as the Trilateral Commission met at the same time in Washington, D.C. With an apparent goal of creating nothing less than a new global economy, Soros is spending $50 million in New Hampshire to bring together up to 200 academic, business, and government policy leaders under his Institute for New Economic Thinking, INET. As AFP went to press on April 7th, the attendees were to include ex-Fed Chairman Paul Volcker, former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, and World Bank executive and Nobel Prize winner in economics Joseph Stiglitz. The conference is slated for the Mount Washington Hotel, site of the historic 1944 Bretton Woods Conference, which established the post-World War II international financial architecture. Soros chose this site because he expects his proposed reforms to be as radical as those promoted by British economist John Maynard Keynes, the much-praised genius of the original Bretton Woods project. Keynesian economics have been portrayed as a cure to the Western world's post-war devastation, and that governments were liberated of money creation restrictions imposed by the gold standard, even while global financiers controlled much of the world's gold as they do now. Governments under the new paradigm after the war were encouraged to promote economic growth and macroeconomic stability by creating more debt-based money for everything that ailed the economy, debt that has today brought most of the world's economies to the brink of bankruptcy. Now Soros comes along as the new Keynes to save the day by proposing another miracle solution to our problems, couched in lofty doublespeak such as reform, cooperation, and equal participation. Soros is proposing the end of sovereignty as we know it. Reorganizing the world order will need to extend beyond the financial system, Soros wrote in his opinion piece. The world faces another stark choice between two fundamentally different forms of organization, international capitalism and state capitalism. The former, represented by the United States, has broken down, and the latter, represented by China, is on the rise. Soros is saying that a washed-up America should be replaced by a world government with a global currency under UN rule. He also advocates that China should be top dog while we play second fiddle. What Soros doesn't say is that two decades of outsourcing U.S. industry, opening the borders and bankrupting the economy with pointless wars and other debacles, have been intentionally orchestrated so that now international bankers can tell the world the system is broken and that the individuals who broke it need to show us how to fix it. Page 2, personal from the editor. 9/11 Truth Gallops Forward. As highlighted in last week's AFP, 9/11 Pentagon survivor and eyewitness April Gallup continued her lawsuit on April 5th against three heavyweight defendants, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and General Richard Myers, at a hearing in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in New Haven, Connecticut. A court watcher tells AFP of the government's stonewalling behavior during the hearing, where the young plaintiff's attorney, William Veal, held his ground. The judges were unbelievable, AFP's inside source reports. Veal was getting in way too many licks for April's case, and they wanted to stop him with obstructionist questions. Meanwhile, about a dozen area law students observed the proceedings with eyes wide open. Ms. Gallup's lawsuit cites a violation of civil rights, conspiracy, and other wrongs. The former Army specialist and her then-infant son showed up at her Pentagon desk on September 11, 2001, and survived the attack. Evidence does not support a jetliner having hit the Pentagon, as the government claims happened. AFP source added, when Veal was done, his opponents who were sitting at the opposite table, namely the government attorneys, were asked to respond. There was a white male and a youngish black woman. The woman got up, gave her name and information, and said they were resting. No response at all. What response is there against the truth? The three judges asked the attorneys if the government was considering sanctions, which are only justified against the most frivolous of cases, AFP's source summarized. But Thiel was in no way worried and said that this would only open the door for him to defend their sanctions motion, which would finally be an opportunity for him to present his case. Ms. Gallup's case remains alive. Another 9/11 hearing, ironically, happened the same day in the same courtroom. Attorney Bruce Leichty, representing 9/11 survivor Ellen Mariani, whose husband, Neil, died on 9/11, also appeared before this appeals court. He and Mariani have long been under a gag order, but stay tuned for more on that case as well. Olga Belinskaya, who directs our First Amendment Books, FAB affiliate, wants to gather a selection of amazing classics. She wants readers to suggest some good book titles because her own research might overlook some great books. Then she can go to the Library of Congress and look through them. I urge AFP readers to send their suggestions to Olga. Please write us at the Washington, D.C. office or email her at fab@americanfreepress.net. Mark Anderson. News you may have missed. Washington can't keep books straight. Washington demands that taxpayers and U.S. businesses keep detailed financial records or face the wrath of the IRS, but don't expect the government to have to do the same. A recent probe by the Government Accountability Office, GAO, unearthed unbelievable accounting errors at some of the largest agencies in the federal government. For example, at the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is tasked with being the ultimate watchdog of Wall Street, the GAO unearthed serious and costly accounting errors that will likely cost taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars. And it was so bad at the Departments of Defense, Labor, and Homeland Security that the GAO could not even audit their books. Bye-bye, Beck. Commentator Glenn Beck's daily Fox News Channel program ends later this year. His departure was jointly announced in a statement by Fox and Mr. Beck's company, Mercury Radio Arts. The two entities who have clashed over details of the Beck performance will work together to produce a variety of television projects on the Fox News Channel, as well as content for other platforms. The statement did not specify an end date for the show, which has been on Fox News since early 2009. Beck's contract ends in December. Worth a try. On April 5th, AFP's Julia Foster called the Washington, D.C. office of the Trilateral Commission, TC, that sterling creation of David Rockefeller and his cronies. Pretending to be a student doing research, Foster asked a TC receptionist, "Can you tell me where the Trilaterals will be meeting the weekend of April 9th and 10th? The receptionist replied, "Tell him, Jim Tucker, it was a nice try." Whites declining. According to new census data, the United States over the past decade would have actually shown a decline in the population of children were it not for an explosion in the numbers of Hispanic and Asian kids. The number of white children, which grew by 1.2%, was eclipsed by the rising number of Hispanics and Asians, which grew by a whopping 43%. Today, white American adults are 67% of the population, while white American kids make up only 54%. Happy birthday, Jefferson. April 13th is the birth date of the great American patriot and founding father Thomas Jefferson. He was born in 1743 in Shadwell, Virginia, and died on July 4th, 1826, at his home plantation at Monticello near Charlottesville, Virginia. This year, Monticello will be commemorating Jefferson's 268th birthday on April 13th at 10 a.m. on the west lawn of Monticello. The event will include music by the U.S. Army's Old Guard Fife and Drum Corps and the presentation of wreaths honoring Jefferson by local, state, and national institutions and organizations. Now, if the government that honors him would only bother honoring his advice against banking power and interventionist wars. Regime change. John Cornyn, Republican, Texas, will be the first senator to introduce a resolution stating that the policy of the U.S. should be to remove Muammar Gaddafi from power and to use military force if necessary to achieve that goal. What makes Cornyn think that the United States has a right to remove from power anyone politicians and lobbyists don't like in a country that has done nothing to us? If he wants the American military to go around replacing world leaders, maybe we should start right here at home. President Barack Obama and recent presidents have done more to harm the United States than Libya's leader ever could. Barack trumped by Donald. Flamboyant billionaire Donald Trump caused quite a stir in the mainstream media recently by questioning President Obama's legitimacy as president due to lack of evidence of a valid birth certificate. "The reason I have a little doubt, just a little, is because he grew up and nobody knew him," said Trump. "If I got the nomination, if I decide to run, you may go back and interview people from my kindergarten. They'll remember me." He noted that nobody seems to know Obama until later in his life. "The whole thing is very strange," said Trump. Trump is sending an investigator to Hawaii to check on Obama's records. Page 3, AFP on the Federal Reserve. Fed data dump reveals billions in foreign bailouts. Representative Ron Paul calls for probe as head of influential House Domestic Monetary Policy Subcommittee by Christopher J. Petherick. Texas Republican Representative Ron Paul announced on April 4th as head of the powerful House Domestic Monetary Policy Subcommittee. He will be initiating congressional hearings into reports the Federal Reserve made hundreds of billions of dollars worth of sweetheart loans to foreign banks. Fed officials had tried desperately to keep the details of these transactions under wraps by repeatedly appealing a lawsuit that was brought by two reporters working for the New York-based Bloomberg News. They argue that if the details of such deals are released, the public would lose confidence in the banking system. In late March, however, the Supreme Court upheld previous rulings by lower courts that the Fed must comply with the information requests. So, the Fed dumped hundreds of pages of records onto the public. Over the course of the April Fool's Day weekend, AFP's editors were able to examine a portion of the Fed's documents, only to learn that the joke has always been on the American people. In 2008, banks around the world were struggling to stay solvent as their risky trading and complex derivatives weighed heavily on their balance sheets. As a result, the Fed at varying times made hundreds of billions of dollars worth of emergency loans at its discount window. Such transactions are usually only reserved for lending of last resort to institutions that cannot get funding from anywhere else, such as by floating more stock or selling bonds. Some of the largest banks, such as Wachovia and Morgan Stanley, repeatedly hit up the Fed for short-term loans worth billions of dollars. From September 18, 2008 to September 24, 2008, Washington Mutual borrowed $2 billion every day until its collapse on September 25, 2008. It was eventually bought out by J.P. Morgan in a now infamous fire sale. But what shocked Fed watchers the most was the volume of transactions the private central bank conducted with foreign banks. In thousands of emergency loans, foreign banks repeatedly came to the Fed asking for U.S. dollars at near 0% interest rates. At varying times, some of the top borrowers included Brussels-based Dexia Bank, $33.5 billion, Dublin-based Deptfa Bank, $24.5 billion, Paris-based Societe Generale, $5 billion, Tokyo-based Norinchukin, $6 billion, Bank of China, $198 million, and two Deutsche Bank AG divisions, $1 billion each. One of the most controversial was the Arab Banking Corp, which borrowed more than $35 billion. Arab Banking Corp is 35% owned by the Central Bank of Libya. Regardless of what readers may think of Libya, the Federal Reserve made an estimated 73 loans to the Central Bank of Libya, the national bank of a country the U.S. military is currently bombing. In an official statement on the Fed's data dump, Representative Paul said, "These lending activities provided no benefit to American taxpayers, the American economy, or even directly to American banks. It is becoming more and more obvious that the Fed operates for the benefit of a few privileged banks, banks that never suffer for bad decisions they make. Quite the opposite, as we have seen since October 2008. Under our current monetary system, politically connected banks are paid to make bad decisions." Page 4, Resisting the Global Elite. Trilateral Commission is concerned Americans are catching on to them, by James P. Tucker, Jr. Leaders of the Trilateral Commission, TC, who met behind closed doors at 1957 East Street Northwest in Washington the weekend of April 9 to 10, are upset that Americans realize their war against Libya is for the purpose of sowing more unrest in the Middle East, stealing that nation's riches, and making the United States a greater target for terrorism and other forms of retribution. AFP first reported that rebel forces may not be completely under the thumb of the Western powers. Subsequently, the mainstream media felt compelled to include the information, buried deep in their stories. "This will make it much harder to pursue the war in Libya," said Joseph F. Nye, Jr., according to an inside source. "These people will try to scare congressmen out of supporting military action of any kind." Nye, TC's North American chairman, was speaking with Michael Fuchs, European deputy chairman, and Mario Monti, European chairman. "They have scared the hell out of Robert Gates," said Fuchs, referring to the U.S. Secretary of Defense. "Others are squirming too," said Monti, naming Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. Both are members of the TC and Bilderberg, which will meet in Switzerland in June. Both groups see war in Libya as a means of invading Iran on behalf of Israel. Leaders of both groups will enjoy immense profits from war profiteering. The costs in American blood and treasure will be high, but this will help perpetuate the global recession, which they also desire. Global economic stress, they maintain, is key to establishing world government. There was much nattering about the need to balance the world economy, as in reducing America's standard of living while improving the economy in the rest of the world. By forcing the price of fuel skyward, TC and its brother group, the more exclusive Bilderberg, plan to perpetuate the U.S. recession, which their cheerleading economists insist is over. By increasing oil prices, TC and Bilderberg will force general prices to increase while unemployment remains high. On average, 25% to as much as 40% of what you pay for any product is attributed to the cost of transportation and the long journey from raw material to finished product at the marketplace. Internationalists complain that even at $4 a gallon, Americans fare much better than Europeans, who pay $7. They want costs in America to rise to a similar level, generating huge profits. They celebrate the fact that Americans produce more while earning less. Many consumer prices have gone up more than 5% in 3 weeks. Now that Americans are no longer in combat, said one, we can keep the war going. But the reality is the United States is still paying the bulk of NATO's expenses to keep the war going in Libya. Early arrivals to the TC meeting included Jürgen Kroger of the European Commission and Konstantin Papadopoulos of the Greek Foreign Ministry. EU Socialist-Style Economics Failing Across Europe, by Richard Walker. The recent London protests that brought approximately 500,000 family members and public service workers onto the streets and led to an unfortunate sideshow of 500 masked and angry protesters battling the police was more evidence of growing anger toward austerity cuts and autocracy. The largest protest of its kind in 2 decades, the event reflected increased public disillusionment with bank bailouts, tax concessions for the super rich, reduced public service pay, and significantly increased university tuition fees. The protest organizer, Trades Union Congress, TUC, of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, claimed it was time for people to show they were the big society and not government. One union leader told marchers they were on the streets to bear witness as the government created another jobless generation so the rich and greedy could live as they pleased. His anger was palpable in a massive march comprised of families and pensioners and workers representing all public sector professions, including nursing, the fire service, and local authorities. Violence by more than 500 masked protesters, many armed with cudgels, ammonia bombs, flares, fireworks, and stones, left several policemen and some protesters bloodied and injured. More than 200 protesters were arrested and charged with public order offenses, while many were treated for minor injuries. In the wake of the violence, which marred a generally peaceful protest, the government declared it would give the police new powers. The announcement was met with criticism by the trade union, which promised more protests throughout 2011. Some observers saw the government's reaction as a strategy to use tougher police controls to curb future demonstrations. Growing disenchantment with governments that are in the pocket of the super rich and with globalization is being expressed throughout the European Union. The Germans, however, are leaving the rhetoric to others as they continue to show their country is the economic engine of Europe and one of the most successful economies globally. Germany has beaten all the odds and does not have to bend to political or economic pressure from London, Paris, or Washington anymore. It is proving it can go alone, ignoring calls to fall into line with broader EU centralized policies. Essentially, it has drawn on its engineering brilliance, high-end products, and production capacity to compete. It has 82 million people, making it the largest EU nation. Though it is minuscule compared to China, Germany has also shown it has China's ability to develop a highly efficient export output. While Germany may no longer be the failing elder statesman of Europe, a moniker it earned following the unification of the East and the West, there is little optimism elsewhere in the EU. Many political groups are arguing that global economic models have created blighted economies. Ireland and Greece are stark examples of nations suffering severe economic hardship because of the massive bailout of greedy banks and other financial institutions. Some commentators are predicting the financial malaise is so deeply rooted it will soon take down the economies of Spain and Portugal. Ordinary Europeans are beginning to warn that the one-size-fits-all concept promoted by the EU is a dangerous ideal and could likely spell the end of this experiment in European government. Page 6, AFP on the Tea Party Movement. Major Tea Party rally takes place in Washington, D.C. by Stephen Lombardo. On March 31st, Tea Party members gathered in the shadow of the U.S. Capitol building in their latest verbal outrage against the liberal, out-of-control spending policies that are adding to the debt of the American people. It's a hole that keeps getting deeper and deeper with no apparent end in sight. AFP was there to hear key issues addressed by several notable speakers centering around excessive federal spending. They included Andrew Langer, the president of the Institute for Liberty, Joe Walsh, Republican Illinois, Representative Louis Gohmert, Republican Texas, and Representative Michelle Bachmann, Republican Minnesota. Walsh stood out, having choice words for those legislators who want to increase, not cut, the federal budget. "Have that boot ready to put somewhere where the sun doesn't shine," said Walsh. "Keep us going. We do not have a lot of time, folks. Keep the pressure on us." Sadly, what was missing from the event was any reference to the military-industrial complex and the unnecessary wars currently being waged in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya. These make up a significant portion of central government spending. Also absent was any discussion among Tea Party members about the international banks and their cronies. These organizations really run the system, as well as both major parties. Tea Party members would be wise to look at reining in bomb makers and banks. American taxpayers could save trillions of dollars by simply bringing our troops home and ending bailouts for Wall Street. Democrats caught sabotaging Tea Party by James B. Tucker Jr. Two former Democratic leaders in Michigan faced criminal charges for allegedly attempting to get fake Tea Party candidates on ballots last November. This comes after two U.S. congressmen were accused of lying when they claimed Tea Party protesters spat on them. It fits a media pattern of attempting to paint typically peaceful protesters as impolite, potentially violent fools. Former Oakland County Democratic Party Chairman Michael McGinnis and former Operations Director Jason Bauer were indicted March 16th on forgery and perjury charges. Bauer also faces three counts of notary fraud. Facing up to 14 years in prison if convicted, they were each released on $25,000 bond. The indictment accuses them of trying to install three people on the ballot without their knowledge. Aaron W. Tyler and Ruth Ann Spearman were to be county commission candidates. Jonathan M. Young was to be a state senate candidate. The suspects forged the signatures on the affidavit of identity and falsely swore under oath to qualify their three victims to run, the indictment alleges. Bauer stepped down from his position following allegations that he notarized and filed papers for 13 sham candidates from the Michigan Tea Party, noted a report at the website senatorteaparty.com. In September, Michigan Circuit Court judges authorized a one-man grand jury to investigate the allegations. The Michigan Supreme Court also blocked the fake candidates from appearing on the ballot. Republican and Tea Party officials had expressed suspicion that the Michigan Tea Party was being manipulated to enhance the chances of Democratic candidates in a candidate-snatching scheme carried out by forging the names of unsuspecting minor candidates. This behavior follows a year-long pattern of shabby characters sometimes shown displaying Tea Party signs while cavorting at the rallies of polite and better-groomed Tea Party participants, where an obliging media pursues the unkempt Tea Partiers for photographs suggesting their appearance is typical. During one of numerous peaceful Tea Party rallies on Capitol Hill protesting big federal spending sprees, Representatives John Lewis, Democrat Georgia, and Charles Rangel, Democrat New York, claimed they had been spat upon by rally participants. Of course, they were swarmed by broadcasters and journalists asking their opinion about the Tea Party. Both groused that Tea Partiers had spat on them. The congressman's allegations have been challenged by honest media outlets, including AFP. Page 8, AFP's Spotlight on Congress. Paul grills chairman of the Fed, promises action to rein in banks. In a rare moment of sanity in Washington, D.C., Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke was dragged before the House Financial Services Committee in early March to testify about the state of the U.S. economy and what role the privately owned and controlled central bank's monetary policy has played in the latest spate of price increases. In his opening statement, Representative Ron Paul, Republican Texas, who chairs the House's Domestic Monetary Policy and Technology Subcommittee, blasted the Fed for dumping trillions of dollars into the United States in a risky gamble to bolster America's foundering economy. The result of this, he said, has been rising prices for commodities like oil and food. Here's what Paul said in his opening statement. "Every day we hear stories about rising prices, whether it be food, gasoline, or clothing. The cost of living is going up, and not just for Americans, but for people around the globe." The Federal Reserve's program of quantitative easing has taken some of the blame for this, and rightly so, in my opinion. This program, known as QE2, sought to purchase a total of $900 billion in U.S. Treasury debt over a period of 8 months. Roughly $110 billion of newly created money is flooding into markets each month, markets which are still gun-shy after the events of the last few years. Banks still holding underperforming mortgage-backed securities on their books and are hesitant to loan out further money, holding well over $1 trillion on reserve with the Fed. Is it any wonder, then, that this new hot money is flowing into commodities around the world? Later during the hearing, Paul asked the arrogant and visibly annoyed Bernanke, how can you manage monetary policy, which means to manage the dollar, when there is no definition of the dollar? What is your definition of a dollar? Bernanke responded, my definition of the dollar is what it can buy. Consumers don't want to buy gold. They want to buy food and gasoline and clothes and all the other things that are in the consumer basket. It is the buying power of the dollar in terms of those goods and services that is what is important. And that's what I call price stability. Bernanke then added that the Fed has worked to maintain price stability and low unemployment for the past 3 decades. There has been improvement, he claimed. But the truth is, the purchasing power of the dollar has been in a free fall since the Federal Reserve first fired up its printing presses in 1914. According to USinflationCalculator.com, a website maintained by Mike Unser of Coin News, prices have increased by over 2,113.1% since 1914. In other words, what an American could buy for $1 in 1914 would today cost $22.13. But this only tells part of the story. In other sectors, such as housing, inflation has increased by even more. For example, in 1914, Sears sold by mail order beautiful American-made two-story single-family homes for less than $1,500. The kits were delivered by railroad. Today, similar houses can go for $200,000 or more. That's an inflation rate of 13,233%. For too long, the Federal Reserve's monetary policy has led to higher prices and a decreased purchasing power of the dollar, said Paul. It is well overdue that this committee exercise increased oversight and scrutiny on the Fed's actions, and I look forward to further committee action to rein in the Fed. Banker subterfuge shafts homeowners. The Republican-led House voted on March 26th to kill a program created by the White House to help struggling American families avoid foreclosure and stay in their homes. As well-intentioned as it was, the House was right to terminate the Home Assistance Modification Program. The billion-dollar program had turned into a massive boondoggle whereby banks could sit on their hands and still reap a tidy profit courtesy of the American taxpayer. The failure of the program was not entirely the government's fault. Perhaps the worst that could be said was that Washington officials trusted that bankers would want to help hard-working Americans who happened to be down on their luck. But that's not what happened. According to estimates, an estimated 3 million to 4 million Americans could have benefited from the program. But by February 2011, Treasury officials had only signed up about 600,000 families who were seeking government help for their troubled mortgages. Out of that number, 11% had already defaulted by the time Congress stepped in to put them out of their misery. Much of the blame, according to published reports, rested with the bankers, who were blamed for losing paperwork and stalling as time ran out on beleaguered American homeowners. For instance, Ada Caceres, 53, a homeowner in Staten Island, told the New York Times that she sought help for her mortgage with J.P. Morgan Chase. At first, she said she was accepted for a loan modification, which can include a reduced interest rate or better terms. Then she said a banker from Chase called her to inform her bank officials had changed their mind and canceled the modification. I call constantly. They lose all my paperwork, and the same guy never gets on the phone, said Mrs. Caceres. It's key to note that if the bank changes its mind and declines to assist the applicant, it still gets to keep the fees and the thousands in taxpayer dollars given to it. From the moment the program was created, I noted that because mortgage servicers were not compelled to participate, this program would fall short of its goals, said Representative Maxine Waters, Democrat, California, after the House voted to end the program. And in the 2 years that the program has been operational, it's become clear that it's impossible to shame servicers into honoring the program they signed on to. The inability or unwillingness of the Treasury Department to enforce program rules and police servicer behavior has only made things worse. Republicans tell Reid, pass budget cut bill or resign position. Some 80 Republican members of the House recently sent a letter to Senator Harry Reid, Democrat, Nevada, calling on the Senate Majority Leader to pass the current spending bill or resign. Many of the congressmen who signed onto the public letter were newly elected legislators who had ridden the wave of Tea Party support straight to Washington. The Republican-backed spending bill in question would cut over $60 billion from the federal budget. It passed the House in February, but later died in the Senate. With all due respect, if you do not plan to fulfill your responsibilities as Senate Majority Leader, perhaps it's time to step aside, the letter said. Page 9, AFP on the Push for Moral War. Obama's Goddesses of War and the Neocon Agenda by Keith Johnson. American-led airstrikes against Libya were launched on March 19, 2011, 8 years to the day after the U.S. invasion of Iraq. That date is not only significant in terms of American interventionism, but it is also widely celebrated among occult circles. To some, March 19th is a sacred day that commemorates the birth of Minerva, the Roman equivalent to the Greek war goddess Athena. In ancient times, a five-day festival was held in her honor. The Quinquatria, as it was known, was marked by violence and bloodshed as gladiators fought to the death in arenas throughout the Roman Empire. Coincidence? Perhaps. Dismissing any correlation between the birth date of a character out of Roman folklore and two separate U.S. military campaigns might seem reasonable, were it not for the fact that Minerva's symbolism and imagery can be found as an integral part of the U.S. government's shadow identity. Minerva is on the Congressional Medal of Honor, and she is also portrayed in a gigantic mosaic in the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. That said, it shouldn't be too hard to convince even the most staunch skeptic that warmongers in Washington, D.C. don't need to dig deep into mythology to find women who will help them facilitate their hawkish agenda. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has proved herself to be a female symbol of contemporary warfare. She is part of a gang that the nation's Robert Dreyfus refers to as a troika of warrior women. Rounding out this trio are Samantha Power of the National Security Council and Susan Rice, who serves as Barack Obama's ambassador to the United Nations. These so-called liberal interventionists played a role in goading the president into an open-ended war with Libya that cost the American taxpayer more than $400 million in its first 6 days of operation. Many from Obama's staff were opposed to a confrontation with Muammar Gaddafi, but contrary to the advice of Defense Secretary Robert Gates, National Security Advisor Tom Donilon, and Counterterrorism Chief John Brennan, Mrs. Clinton and her femmes fatale instead chose to side with names like Paul Wolfowitz, William Kristol, Elliot Abrams, Robert Kagan, Eric Edelman, and others of that ilk. These notorious pro-Zionist neoconservatives operate out of an organization known as the Foreign Policy Initiative, FPI, which is PNAC 2.0. PNAC, or Project for a New American Century, is a blueprint of war and other forms of conquests and control drawn up by the neocons several years ago. Their meddling has been instrumental in taking America into yet another Israeli-driven excursion. Here's how they made it happen. After 50,000 mercenaries from Israel were sent into Libya to stir up civil unrest in mid-February, the press began propagating disinformation that accused Gaddafi of bombing civilians in Benghazi. The Russians immediately debunked these false rumors, and even Defense Secretary Gates and Admiral Mike Mullins were forced to admit the allegations were completely false. But that didn't stop the FPI from embracing these lies and using them as the basis of a letter they sent to Obama demanding that he end the violence by way of a full-scale military attack. The American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, a powerful lobby, was the next Zionist entity to get involved, giving an endorsement by proxy through Senators Joseph Lieberman, Independent Connecticut, and John McCain, Republican Arizona, who phoned the president from Tel Aviv and insisted that Washington supply Libyan rebels with arms and establish a no-fly zone over the country. Last but not least was the notorious Council on Foreign Relations, CFR. That's where Mrs. Clinton comes in. Though portrayed as a group of nonpartisan thinkers, the CFR runs the State Department and CIA. When Obama spoke to the nation on the Libyan situation, something happened that was unprecedented. Normally, war has a tendency to boost a president's approval rating, but that didn't happen. However, Mrs. Clinton's approval rating soared. Some speculate that Mrs. Clinton may be parlaying her hawkish reputation in a bid for the Oval Office. Page 10, AFP on the War Against Libya. 9/11 fairy tale excuse for endless war. Peace President proves to be more of a warmonger than predecessor he chastised, by Victor Thorne. After suffering through 8 years of the Bush-Cheney war machine, Barack Obama's 2008 victory was supposed to usher in a new era of tranquility. To great acclaim, this recently elected peace president promised hope, change, and an end to the imperialistic aims of his neoconservative predecessor. Yet 2 years later, the United States is now entangled in its third official war as the situation in Libya continues to escalate. Further, to the dismay of his most loyal supporters, Obama's policies are becoming a mirror image of the man he derided for years. The similarities between Bush's Iraq war and Obama's Libyan campaign are particularly troublesome. Both men sought United Nations approval prior to their attacks, while each justified their preemptive attacks on humanitarian grounds. Even eerier, Bush and Obama based these wars on what could potentially happen, i.e. weapons of mass destruction purportedly hidden by Saddam Hussein and a potential slaughter in a Libyan city. In addition, Iraq and Libya both hold vast oil reserves. Each of their leaders was staunchly anti-Israel, and neither neither U.S. president provided clear-cut exit strategies. If that's not enough, Obama has continued the abhorrent Bush-Cheney practice of extraordinary rendition, whereby captured terrorists are drugged and then secretly sent to foreign countries to be tortured. He has kept the prison at Guantanamo Bay open. He has escalated drone predator attacks in Pakistan and has increased troop levels in Afghanistan. Obama even has his own war criminal scandal. Whereas Bush and Rumsfeld were scandalized by the Abu Ghraib nightmare, the current president has to answer for even more inhumane kill team photos that occurred on his watch. This story was detailed in AFP's April 11th edition on page 4, which includes graphic photos of U.S. soldiers taking trophy shots with murdered Afghans. As Daniel Bates and Mark Duell wrote for the Daily Mail on March 29th, in one horrific episode in the latest scandal, troops allegedly threw a grenade at an innocent Afghan boy before chopping off his finger and using it as a gambling chip. Democrats and Republicans alike are incensed by the fact that whereas Bush at least received congressional approval prior to his war efforts in Afghanistan and Iraq, Obama failed to even make that simple gesture. As AFP recently noted, Representative Dennis Kucinich, Democrat Ohio, has gone so far as to label the president's Libyan attack an impeachable offense. After promising not to place any American combat boots on the ground in Libya, on March 30th, Obama signed a secret presidential finding to greenlight covert operations by the CIA and other intel agencies. Prior to this move, activist Ralph Nader declared that if George W. Bush was guilty of war crimes, then so was Obama. Time magazine's Mark Halperin quipped that Obama is more hawkish than the man he replaced. Likewise, filmmaker Michael Moore demanded that Obama return his 2009 Nobel Peace Prize. All of the international meddling and war-making of the Bush and Obama administrations is based on the massive fiction that on September 11, 2001, some terrorists hijacked Boeing 767s, took over the complicated controls, and crashed them into buildings built to withstand any such shock, after which the buildings crashed to the ground. All honest engineers who have analyzed this fairy tale have branded it a ridiculous lie. Meanwhile, Larry Silverstein, the owner of one of the buildings, wants billions of dollars from insurance companies that accept the official line. This fable is even beyond what one can find in the wildest children's storybook. Evidence suggests Libyan rebel leader is CIA asset by Victor Thorne. Americans are supposed to believe that the United States' latest war in Libya is to assist a spontaneous uprising led by desert inhabitants seeking freedom and democracy. But up until his appointment as Libya's rebel leader, Khalifa Haftar lived less than 5 miles from CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. Nary a word has been mentioned during nightly newscasts about the leader who is commandeering Libya's rebel forces. Instead, the media portrays these loose bands of freedom fighters riding around in pickup trucks as simpletons playing a game of cowboys and Indians. Yet the individual officially in charge of these opposition forces is Haftar, a man in his late 60s who once served as Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's top military officer. For the past 2 decades, however, Haftar has been residing in Northern Virginia, only miles away from our nation's capital. Sources who followed Hifter's activities remark that he has no visible means of income, but he's still able to support a large family. Rumors of CIA affiliations have surrounded Haftar since the early 1990s. A 2001 book, Manipulations Africanes, describes how in 1987, Haftar defected from Gaddafi's ranks, only to join the CIA-backed and financed Libyan National Salvation Front. Haftar subsequently formed his own militia unit in Chad, whereupon he waged a rebellion against Gaddafi's Libyan forces. The Washington Post article on March 26, 1996, exposed the frontman for these anti-Gaddafi troops. Its leader is Colonel Khalifa Haftar of a Contra-style group based in the United States called the Libyan National Army, reported the Post. Journalist Jonathan Cunningham cites Haftar as a longtime CIA collaborator, as does reporter Patrick Martin in his article, American Media Silent on CIA Ties to Libya Rebel Commander. Page 11, AFP on the War Against Libya. Abundant Water, Libya's Big Secret, by Victor Thorne. It's called the eighth wonder of the world, yet Libya's great man-made river project, GMMR, is virtually unknown to U.S. citizens. In a country that is 95% desert, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi invested $25 billion to transport water from deep underground aquifers to cities such as Tripoli and Benghazi. The enormity of this endeavor is mind-boggling. As Larry Luxner noted on June 29, 2010, the GMMR would easily stretch from Louisiana to western New Mexico and up into northern Colorado. Furthermore, in what could be seen as a snub to the international bankers, Gaddafi reportedly didn't borrow a cent to finance this massive undertaking. by tapping into 270 ancient wells located beneath the Sahara Desert. Water is delivered not only to cities and agricultural areas, but also to the Grand Omar Mukhtar Reservoir. As the world's second largest repository, this virtual oasis in the desert holds 24 million cubic meters of water. On a planet where water wars could become even more volatile than oil wars, the strategic value of this vital natural resource in northern Africa cannot be overstated. Considering that Libya possesses both oil and water, Gaddafi made a startling prediction at a gala celebration to mark the GMMR's opening. After this achievement, American threats against Libya will double. Bankers covet Libya's vast riches, by Victor Thorne. They're depicted as a disorganized ragtag band of rebels that is attempting to overthrow Libyan strongman Muammar Gaddafi. But in all honesty, Mexico's murderous drug cartels or California's Crips and Bloods gangbangers could conceivably defeat these inexperienced fighters. Yet, despite numerous setbacks and retreats, these rebels have almost miraculously managed to establish a new central bank and national oil company in Libya. As if we're experiencing deja vu when U.S. forces stormed Iraq with the shock and awe bombings in 2003. The first official act they performed was to create a central bank after seizing control of Baghdad. According to journalist Scott Creighton, the U.S.-led Coalition Provisional Authority, CPA, in Iraq, signed over the state-owned central banking system to privately held banking interests, bringing Iraq online with the web of private central banks. That took place the very first day of the CPA's control of Iraq. Today, R.D. Bradshaw states in Understanding Money and War, J.P. Morgan Chase Bank now runs the Iraqi Central Bank. Imagine an American bank operating under the Muslim policy of rejecting interest. Fast forward to 2011, where we see Libya's Transitional National Council, TNC, maintaining a central bank in Benghazi to establish that region's monetary policy, as well as appointing finance ministers. The formation of this banking house is surely an act of retribution. On March 29th, Michael Snyder of The Economic Collapse wrote, "Muammar Gaddafi had threatened to nationalize the oil industry and kick Western oil companies out of the country." Considering Libya's fuel reserves, another problem confronted New World Order plutocrats. Eric Encina of 21st Century Wire described their frustrations. The Central Bank of Libya is 100% state-owned. In order to do business with Libya, globalists must go through its central bank and its national currency, a place where they have absolutely no dominion or power brokering ability. International financiers couldn't manipulate Libya's independent currency, flood their market with dollars, or subject them to rampant inflationary cycles. Encina adds that Tripoli's central bank holds more bullion as a proportion of gross domestic product than any country except Lebanon. If we revert to Iraq in November 2000, Saddam Hussein laid down an edict where he refused to accept U.S. dollars for his country's oil. Since our dollar serves as the world's sole petrocurrency, every country that stockpiles dollars to purchase oil is essentially subsidizing America. U.S. bears brunt of Libya invasion cost, by Mark Anderson. Recently, the White House announced that the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, would be taking over the lion's share of the war in Libya. However, the U.S. pays a disproportionately high share of funding for NATO. Established under the April 4, 1949 Atlantic Charter and based on Article 51 of the UN Charter, NATO now houses 28 nations. The U.S. contribution to NATO's military budget, the largest of its three budgets, is provided through the Department of the Army's Operations and Maintenance account. The U.S. share is approximately 25%, a March 2011 Congressional Research Services CRS report states. In FY 2009 through FY 2011, the U.S. contributed $408.1 million, $425.3 million, and $462.5 million, respectively. The Obama administration requested $449.9 million in its FY 2012 budget. The report explains that there are three accounts: civil, military, and security investment. U.S. shares for the three funds have fallen some over the past three decades, but they still currently range from 22 to 25%. In three waves, 12 Central and Eastern European nations were admitted into the alliance in 1999, 2004, and 2009, the CRS report adds. Costs went up, consequently. But NATO has not merely expanded in size and costs. NATO's military function since 1999 dramatically changed when its air forces brutally attacked Yugoslavia under the Clinton administration. Today, NATO forces are taking part in airstrikes against Libya, for which the U.S. has no congressional mandate to enter into a war. Page 12, AFP on preparedness. Anniversary of major U.S. quake spurs elaborate FEMA exercise, by Keith Hansen. In 8 months, the bicentennial of a catastrophic 2-month period in America's heartland will be observed. It was approximately 2:15 a.m., December 16, 1811, when what is known as the New Madrid Seismic Zone served notice it had awakened. When its reign of terror subsided, it had produced 4 principal quakes and 1,800 aftershocks that would forever change topographical features, swallow small settlements, create lakes, and cause sections of the Mississippi River to flow backward. The final principal earthquake on February 7, 1812, destroyed New Madrid, Missouri, then part of the Louisiana Territory, then the largest community in the area, with a population of 400. It had the great misfortune of sitting atop the quake's epicenter. Should that area now suffer one or more 7 or 8 magnitude earthquakes, the estimated strength of those that struck 200 years ago, the loss of life and destruction could be horrific. Today, earthquakes in the New Madrid seismic zone pose far more perilous hazards beyond the destruction of infrastructure and loss of life in that sector alone. Located within New Madrid's moderate to high shake zones are some 20 nuclear power plants, a dozen major oil trunk lines, and 8 natural gas pipelines, oft forgotten but volatile components that could wreak widespread havoc if ruptured. An indelible visual of such a catastrophe was offered by Steve Geller, former lead Democrat in the Florida Senate, while speaking to the insurance industry about catastrophic events several years ago. Virtually every natural gas pipeline in the nation is built over that fault, Geller said. You'll see the explosion reflected off the moon. But neither that possible devastation nor the anniversary of the 1811 event appears to be the impetus behind the Federal Emergency Management Agency's FEMA planning of its national level exercise 2011 NLE-11, a 6-month emergency preparedness program that kicked off April 6th. The exercise, unprecedented in scope, is aimed at preparing local, state, and federal agencies in an 8-state region to function with little or no loss in continuity should the area be confronted with, as it states in FEMA's Private Sector Participant Guide, the catastrophic nature of a major earthquake. But why now? Seeking an answer to that question, AFP contacted FEMA's Office of External Affairs, OEA. Although failing to grant a direct interview, OEA tersely responded by email as to the timing of this event. Planning began several years ago. This indicates that FEMA, which is conducting its first national exercise to simulate responding to a natural hazard, was not motivated by undisclosed information that a catastrophic earthquake was imminent. Although a catastrophic earthquake may not happen soon, those familiar with the region's history of seismic activity know the exercise could not have come soon enough. The New Madrid zone is the most active area, in terms of earthquakes, east of the Rocky Mountains, said David Applegate, Ph.D., U.S. Geological Survey Senior Science Advisor. Particularly in light of past events and ongoing seismicity, we feel there is still a very real hazard. Existing dangers lurking beneath the region were laid out plainly in the article, Earthquake Hazard in the New Madrid Seismic Zone, which appeared in the August 2009 United States Geological Survey fact sheet. The New Madrid Seismic Zone is a source of continuing small and moderate earthquakes, which attest to the high stress in the region and indicate that the processes that produced large earthquakes over the previous 4,500 years are still operating. There is no sign that the rate of these smaller earthquakes is decreasing with time, as would be expected if they were aftershocks of the 1811 to 1812 earthquakes. There has been some discussion whether recent activity in the Ring of Fire, most notably the Japan and New Zealand earthquakes, will have an impact on faults in the United States. Opinions on the issue are, at best, split. Robert K. Denton, a senior geologist with GeoConcepts Engineering, Inc. in Ashburn, Virginia, told AFP, "Even with state-of-the-art technology and the best understanding of plate tectonics, the answer is really nebulous. The truthful answer is, we don't know. But one thing is for sure, whenever FEMA gets involved, all Americans should be concerned." Suggested viewing: holes in heaven, HARP, weather modification, mind control, and Tesla technology. Narrated by Martin Sheen, DVD, 50 minutes, $25 plus $3 shipping and handling. Order from First Amendment Books, 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, number 100, Washington, D.C., 20003. Tom Brown's field guides are a great preparedness resource. Wild, edible, and medicinal plants guide. For untold thousands of years, human beings have thrived on the nutritional and medicinal wealth of the plant life in the natural world. In these fascinating, wide-ranging, wonderfully informative stories, Tom Brown, director of the world-famous Tracking Nature and Wilderness Survival School, tells all about the uncommon benefits of the common trees, shrubs, flowers, and other plants we find around us. This indispensable guide includes information on how to use every part of the plant, where to find useful plants, and the best time of the year to harvest them, plus how to prepare delicious food and teas from the riches of the outdoors. Includes an incredible range of experience proven medicinal uses to treat headaches, burns, digestive disorders, skin problems, and a host of other maladies. Soft cover, 241 pages. City and Suburban Survival Guide. Today, most Americans live in the city or suburbs, a safe, comfortable life, at least on the surface. Few of us realize how close we are to the elemental struggle for survival until disaster strikes. Yet, it is possible to be prepared. In this uniquely practical handbook by survival expert Tom Brown, you'll be taught the specific skills and detailed knowledge you need to protect yourself and those you love in almost any emergency. Alternative heat and light sources, preventing and coping with electrical failure, automobile survival techniques, protecting your home from intruders, unconventional food sources for the city dweller, surviving earthquakes, floods, blizzards, hurricanes, and other natural disasters. You'll also get important information on guarding against urban crime. Soft cover, 266 pages. Each book is $17. Order from AFP's First Amendment Books, 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, number 100, Washington, D.C., 20003. Add $3 shipping and handling for one book. Add $5 shipping and handling for both. To charge to Visa, MasterCard, Amex, or Discover, call toll-free 1-888-699-6397. Also order on the web at www.americanfreepress.net. Page 13, AFP on Illegal Immigration. Maternity Ward Tourism for Rich Remains Legal by Frank Whalen. A lesser-known trend in getting around immigration laws in the United States is something called maternity ward tourism. While it's not new, this service caters to wealthy foreigners and currently remains intact. It allows pregnant women from throughout the world to visit the United States briefly, have their babies here, and make them American citizens. The commonly used term anchor babies has been tossed around for ages and typically refers to poor illegal immigrants from Mexico who sneak into the United States to bear children who automatically become American citizens. With a newborn U.S. citizen to care for, the illegal parents try to stay here in order to raise their child. Technically, immigration law says newborn U.S. citizens cannot sponsor their parents for a visa until that child has reached the age of 21 and is earning wages above the poverty level. Therefore, the entire family would have to go back home until the child becomes an adult. Benefits for the newborn do not generally extend to the parents except in cases of extreme hardship. Liberals in Washington have been trying to ease these laws, but so far sensible Democrats and Republicans have been able to block any of these so-called reforms. What makes maternity ward tourism unique is that the target demographic is pregnant women who can afford services that include hotel-like suites, prenatal meals, visa counseling, and pampering for expectant mothers seeking to give birth in the United States, according to a report in the Pasadena Star News. Chinese language websites regularly advertise these types of services. Costs to the mother can be as high as $30,000 for only a few weeks. Other websites are selling maternity ward tourism without even a pretense of staying in the United States after the birth has occurred. They suggest applying for a tourist visa as soon as a pregnancy has been discovered and then arriving when the mother is in her seventh month of pregnancy. From there, immigration law is cited and the mothers are encouraged to follow through with the plan even though they cannot stay in the U.S. post-pregnancy. These children and future generations will automatically become U.S. citizens. As of right now, this is still legal as the mother has been granted a tourism visa and therefore has permission from the U.S. government to be here. The Pasadena Star News cites officials who say statistics on the number of babies born via birth tourism are not available, since the U.S. State Department doesn't track the number of pregnant women who enter the country on a tourist visa. But that could all change thanks to increasing numbers of conservative legislators who are fed up with people taking advantage of U.S. laws. Some Republican lawmakers, noted the Huffington Post Online, have argued recently that the 14th Amendment, which grants automatic citizenship to people born on U.S. soil, should be modified to exclude children of foreign citizens. They contend the lure of U.S. citizenship for children is promoting illegal immigration. Most Americans are more concerned about the pervasive drug, weapon, and human smuggling, a along the Mexico-U.S. border than they are about such a loophole. However, this exploitation is having a dramatic impact, albeit slowly. By some estimates, in 21 years, the immigration debate in the United States will be more focused on the Chinese population than the Mexican population. One such maternity ward was recently shut down when San Gabriel code enforcement officials in California responded to a complaint about noise and an unusual number of pregnant women in a Palm Avenue neighborhood, the LA Times noted. The New York Times quoted City Inspector Clayton Anderson, who was the one who shut down the ward. "These were not women living in squalor," he said, "but there were a lot of women and babies." The facility's owner was fined $800 only for illegal construction. Page 14, AFP on the global elite. CEO of largest corporation in U.S. set to head Obama advisory panel, by Mark Anderson. Most Americans have come to realize that big business directs the federal government and that small-town America and the average person too often are left chewing on scraps. So it's hardly surprising that someone like General Electric Chief Executive Officer Jeffrey Immelt is replacing former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker as head of a prominent economic panel advising the Obama administration. Immelt will help ensure that the government does not get any silly notions about nationalist economics replacing internationalist economics. Immelt understands what it takes for America to compete in the global economy, Obama was quoted as saying. Obama's economic homily was given as he joined Immelt during a recent event in Schenectady, New York, the birthplace of GE's energy business. In announcing Immelt's appointment to take the helm of the newly renamed President's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness, Obama said the economy is in a different place from where it was during the financial crisis when Volcker was brought on, and new ideas are needed to keep the momentum going, added Bloomberg News, which maintained the grand illusion that only corporate heavyweights, such as Immelt, have anything meaningful to say on economic recovery. But the fortunes of GE, America's largest corporation, are not limited to its chief giving the government advice. The well-known company does not owe any U.S. income taxes for 2010. Carl Persson, a longtime contact of this AFP writer, finds that especially interesting. Persson, an innovative Manhattan attorney, is busy devising ways to counteract the noxious influence of big business in a country whose last two treasury chiefs came straight from Goldman Sachs. A recent New York Times report noted that GE does not currently owe any federal income tax, even though the company reported worldwide profits of $14.2 billion, a tax benefit of $3.2 billion, with $5.1 billion of its total profits coming from its U.S. operations. Person responded, "They allocate their expenses to the U.S., though they have operations in many other countries. So GE writes off expenses regarding U.S. operations, but claims taxable profits only in relatively low tax havens outside the states. That's what globalization has created, an opportunity not to pay taxes here but still sell products here," added Person. "The government is then denied revenue it should be receiving from GE and many other corporations while citizens toil, rarely get a tax reprieve, and are too dependent on corporations for whatever employment remains. Global companies like GE are exceedingly tough to monitor for enforcing tax laws. It's all too gigantic for the U.S. government to handle," Person observed. Like Person, another economic activist, Dr. E. Michael Jones, is tired of the corporatocracy and its stranglehold on America. Fresh from an insightful economics conference covered by AFP in the April 4th edition, Jones said that GE's non-payment of U.S. taxes and involvement advising the government underscores how big business is put on a pedestal, but that the looting of pension funds and Social Security is shown in its proper light, since the federal government's revenue losses when corporations don't pay taxes have to be recovered somehow. "It always comes down to looting labor," Jones said. Late author Gus Stelzer, a General Motors executive who was a rare working man's hero, often said that whatever one may think of the federal government's shocking spending excesses, big companies should not be allowed to escape their tax obligations and still receive the privilege of selling their foreign-produced products in the U.S. market with hardly any tariffs attached. When they get away with this, they deny the federal government import revenue while undercutting the manufacturing base. Much-needed wages and revenues are killed that domestic manufacturing typically generates. Meanwhile, the IMELTs of the world receive huge salaries and bonuses no matter what happens to the workers that make GE's products. If production is offshored in pursuit of cheaper labor and lower taxes, profits for those at the top increase even more. Indeed, as the Times noted, various tax shelters, credits, and subsidies, as well as changes in tax laws that encourage some businesses and professionals to file as individuals, have pushed down the corporate share of the nation's tax receipts from 30% of all federal revenue in the mid-1950s to 6.6% in 2009. Page 15, Financial Solutions for Americans. New York activist has planned to help Americans get jobs and education by Mark Anderson. Noted New York attorney Carl Persson spoke to AFP April 3rd as he headed to Liberty, New York to establish more contacts for battling the worst corporations of all, the banks, by helping average Americans recover their homes from foreclosure. Persson, a former state attorney general candidate, also advocates sharply increasing the level of self-employment to free Americans from the corporate job trap that indentures many to work for corporate entities. "You've got to get rid of the usurers and monopolists," said Persson. Liberty, an aptly named town of about 4,000 people with a median household income of $28,000, is a typical place that Persson says is in need of something else he advocates, a town attorney general who brings the power of a state attorney general down to the local level in a newly created position. Such an official would enforce residents' rights and offer community-level protections by fighting the corporate takeover of Main Street America, such as when Walmart moves in and provides meager-paying jobs while funneling money out of the community and spurring the closure of locally owned hardware stores and other downtown mainstays. Persson is testing the waters in Liberty and other towns with ideas such as locally owned credit unions, local currencies, and what he describes as a tuition-free equivalency college for area-wide residents. This, he said, would provide increased skills, internet, marketing, manufacturing, farming, renewable energy, self-employment, starting small businesses, servicing small businesses, etc. The college degree sanctioned by the current system costs too much, often with too little return, he says. When faced with the grim prospect of corporations and banks ruling the roost, getting mad is one thing, but getting active is better in order to directly help Main Street when Washington pretends all solutions come from the top. The key, says Persson, is to start meaningful discussions and get constructive ideas flowing for realistic recovery plans, instead of settling for more empty announcements from the latest federal advisory panel. Page 17, One-on-One with Dave Gahary. Secret Policy Bans U.S. Mention of Israeli Nukes by Dave Gahary. Israel's official policy regarding its nuclear capability is explained in the Hebrew word amimut, which means nuclear opacity, that is, official secrecy about its arsenal of weapons of mass destruction. In order to more fully understand the ramifications, American Free Press interviewed Israeli-born Dr. Avner Cohen, a senior fellow at the Washington, D.C.-based James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies. Cohen is an internationally acclaimed expert and author of The Worst-Kept Secret, Israel's Bargain with the Bomb. The book was nearly 10 years in the making as it relied heavily on declassified documents, including many White House memos. Although they are widely recognized to possess between 75 and 400 nuclear weapons, for over 40 years to this very day, Israel has never acknowledged this and has committed to say essentially nothing about its stance on this issue, explained Cohen. "The whole world knows it," he continued, "which is why this is the worst-kept secret." The main reason the policy has remained in place for so long is that, according to Cohen, Israel's national security elite see no realistic alternative to amimut. The roots of amimut can be found in what Cohen contends was a still-secret oral agreement reached on September 26, 1969, between President Richard Nixon and Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir during an evening stroll on the White House lawn. There, Cohen believes, Mrs. Meir spilled the beans on Israel's nuclear accomplishments, and Nixon saw no other option than to keep this information under wraps, primarily in order to maintain the existing global nonproliferation regime. Some of Cohen's critics note that although much of his thesis is founded on the idea that such a secret agreement was reached between Nixon and Mrs. Meir, there is no documentary evidence of this. Rather, the thesis is based on Cohen's own speculation, as a close reading of his actual book makes clear. Part of the policy of opacity, or amimut, said Cohen, is the fact that both Israel and the United States do not say anything in public that implies that Israel has nuclear weapons. American officials cannot imply knowledge of Israeli possession of nuclear weapons. Since amimut is an oral and not written agreement, all U.S. presidents since Nixon have been briefed about it. According to Cohen's book, when Jimmy Carter assumed the presidency in 1977, Israel was so concerned the accord might not reach the new president that it asked Kissinger to personally brief him. More recently, when Obama was set to occupy the White House, then Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert asked outgoing President Bush to make sure to tell the president-elect about the agreement. Cohen emphasized the importance of Israel maintaining its secrecy about its nukes. As long as Israel does not openly acknowledge its nuclear status, I think Arab states feel more comfortable because it covers their sense of weakness in relation to Israel, he said. A shift in Israeli nuclear policy, precipitated by more popularly led Arab regimes and Iran's nuclear ambitions, however, can make the Arab world recognize their military inferiority and force them to puff out their chests, so to speak. Although Cohen does not believe a nuclear-armed Iran would be an existential threat to Israel, as claimed by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, he believes the prospect would be very significant. In Cohen's opinion, there's no question that it would challenge in a very critical way the Israeli posture of national security. It could give a sense of confidence to Iran's proxies, Syria, Hezbollah, and perhaps Hamas. It can create a situation that Iran would be much more assertive and aggressive in trying to dominate the region. The secret policy may also be forced to change for other reasons. Cohen believes that because amimut is incompatible with the basic values of democracy, the time has come to revisit, re-examine, and perhaps relax this policy. He added, part of this book is an effort, a plea, to start a discussion and gradually move away from that policy. For more on Israel's secret arsenal of nuclear weapons, order a copy of The Golem, Israel's Nuclear Hell Bomb and the Road to Global Armageddon, which describes how development of a nuclear arsenal was the foundation of Israeli policy from the beginning. This book by AFP's Michael Collins Piper is available only from First Amendment Books. Softcover, 182 pages, $25 plus $3 shipping and handling. Send cash, check, or money order to First Amendment Books at 645 Pennsylvania Avenue South, East, number 100, Washington, D.C., 20003. For faster ordering, call us toll-free at 1-888-699-6397 in charge. Page 18, Tough Talk from Jim Trafficant. Federal state budget shortfalls could fracture America, by Jim Trafficant. We are awash in guesstimates, which are really nothing more than basic guesses. With that in mind, let's review the ongoing projections of two differing entities, the supposedly neutral Congressional Budget Office, CBO, and the White House. Frankly, I was never sold on the nonpartisanship of the CBO. In most cases, the CBO seems to support the position of the party in power. The CBO will deny this statement, but who else would challenge it? This is what makes the following controversy so interesting. The CBO says that the White House and Barack Obama have underestimated future budget deficits by more than $2 trillion over the upcoming decade. That's more than $200 billion a year. The CBO estimates that if Obama's February budget submission is enacted into law, it would produce deficits totaling $9.5 trillion over 10 years, close to $1 trillion per year. The White House has projected the 10-year accumulative budget deficit to be a lean $7.2 trillion. Lean? Regardless of what kind of math you apply, the national debt will be at least $25 trillion by 2021, and that is only the amount officially acknowledged. Such a debt can be neither comprehended nor paid. But I earnestly predict, and this is not a guesstimate, that the next 10 years of budget deficits will exceed $15 trillion, an average of $1.5 trillion in new debt per year. How can it miss? This year's deficit alone will exceed $1.6 trillion. The working taxpayer will be burdened with servicing every dollar of such a debt that ideally should be repudiated. We're talking about a projected national debt of $30 trillion. America has now become a non-sustainable managed debt economy, or NSMDE, and the states are in quite a quagmire. Their respective financial shortfalls are choking their budgets. The states are asking for one of two things, more federal stimulus money, or for Congress to pass legislation that will allow the states to file bankruptcy. Even tiny Rhode Island is facing a $300 billion budget deficit. You can just imagine the plight of California and New York. Tell me, how can Congress dole out more stimulus money while facing a $1.6 trillion budget deficit and fighting various wars? Should Congress pass legislation allowing the states to file bankruptcy? What would happen to the bond markets? What impact would that have on borrowing costs? To me, it's obvious it would be a disaster. In addition, since Congress bailed out a bunch of bad banks, criminal banks, the die is cast. If you fail, Mr. Banker, the government will bail you out. Therefore, take the risk. You'll be subsidized again. Your home has lost 25% to 35% of its resale value, but have your property taxes been reduced? In some cases, property taxes are as high as the original mortgage payment for seniors who have owned their homes for more than 25 years, maybe higher. I predicted this 15 years ago. Stevie Wonder could see this coming. No one wanted to face it. So which state will be the first to collapse? California? New York? The old Soviet Union broke up into a bunch of so-called independent states. That, in my view, could happen here unless bold strategies are put into effect. Meanwhile, state governments are trying to curb state workers' collective bargaining rights. They want to reduce the number of state workers and their pay levels. Yes, many workers are not needed, but many of the politicians now complaining were the ones who created state jobs to gain votes. Property owners, beware. Get back at me. The Ryan Report from Vince Ryan. Free trade continues to ravage U.S. economy, workers, by Vince Ryan. The story headline in the online edition of the Christian Science Monitor, dated April 1st, reads, "Cost of U.S. Free Trade? Collapse of Two Centuries of Broadly Shared Prosperity." But this was no April Fool's Day joke. It's a deadly serious story about how a reckless free trade policy is destroying America's jobs machine. The article's author, Ian Fletcher, continues, "Since the end of the Cold War and accelerating after NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, in 1994, Washington has pursued a globalized economy made possible by ever-expanding free trade agreements. This policy is a major factor in America's increasing inequality, our rising indebtedness, community abandonment, and the weakening of the industrial sinews of our national security." He added, "The good news is that this global order of free trade is about to crumble within the next 10 years at most. The unsustainable American trade deficit, fluctuating around $500 billion a year for a decade now, acts as a giant reverse stimulus. It causes a huge slice of domestic demand to flow not into domestic jobs, but to foreign wages. Our trade deficit helps Guangdong, China, on the South China Sea, Seoul, Korea, Yokohama, Japan, even Munich, Germany, but not Gary, Indiana, Fontana, California, and the other badlands of America's industrial decline. Washington's response? Even more stimulus, leading to an ever-increasing overhead of debt, both foreign and domestic, the cost of whose servicing them exerts its own drag on the community." Writing in the Wall Street Journal March 30, 2011, Senator Marco Rubio, Republican Florida, said that, "We have an unsustainable national debt. Leaders of both parties have grown our government for decades by spending money we didn't have. To pay for it, they borrowed $4 billion a day, leaving us with today's $14 trillion official debt. Half of that debt is held by foreign investors, mostly China." Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 of the U.S. Constitution gives Congress the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with Indian tribes. Tariffs on imports would be the principal method of paying for running the government. In fact, tariffs were a major federal revenue source for the first 125 years of the nation. There would be a congressionally regulated commerce with foreign nations in between the states. Any kind of laissez-faire laws letting the people, states, or government operate without regulations is prohibited. Surprisingly, according to the China Daily, Commerce Minister Chen Diming reported a February trade deficit of $7.3 billion, the first since March 2010, and reported another such deficit for March 2011. China's surplus has declined by 6.4% to $183.1 billion after a 34% fall in 2009. According to Fletcher, from 1790 to 1945, America grew and prospered in a largely protected economic environment. Our trade then was not free, but after World War II, we wandered away from Alexander Hamilton's vision of a relatively self-contained American economy in order to win the Cold War. We threw our markets open to the world as a bribe not to go communist. If we fail to return to a policy of strategic, not unconditional, economic openness, we may lose the next Cold War to a Confucian authoritarianism no less opposed to the idea of a free society than Marxism and considerably more efficient. What Americans should always remember is that free trade is not free but comes with a hefty price tag. Greedy corporate America can produce its products anywhere it chooses, even in countries countries dominated by slave labor. Corporate heads have little or no concern for Americans. They are focused on making huge profits for shareholders, which usually translates into big bonuses for top business leaders at the expense of Main Street. However, if products are made in America by Americans and for Americans, business will have a natural incentive to care about American productivity and consumption, a good formula for prosperity. So-called free trade, the enemy of freedom, will have been a bad dream. Ian Fletcher is the author of the book, Free Trade Doesn't Work, What Should Replace It and Why. Originally $25, now just $13. 323 pages, soft cover, at $3 shipping and handling. Available from First Amendment Books. Call 1-888-699-NEWS toll-free to charge to a major credit card.